The Federal News Update for Friday, January 2, 2026.
I'm Sam Kennedy.
And I'm Alex Johnson. Welcome back to The Deep Dive. Our mission today, for you, is to construct the most exhaustive, granular archival record possible of federal actions that were either taken or operationalized on January 1st, 2026.
Right.
We are not interested in the headlines. We are diving deep into the technical nuance, the specific numeric details across all three branches of the U.S. government.
It's an ambitious mission, but I think a necessary one, especially given the weight of the sources we're looking at. What we're seeing isn't just, you know, routine bureaucracy kicking off the new year.
No, this feels different.
This looks like the immediate, aggressive implementation of the administration's entire second-term agenda. We can really define this effort by a distinct and powerful triad of governing themes.
Okay, lay out that triad for us. What's the overarching strategic framework you see guiding all these different actions?
It's visible everywhere, from the border right through to the budget. The themes are deterrence through denial. That's what's dominating immigration policy.
Okay.
Then there's peace through strength, which is dictating defense and foreign policy investment. Hmm. And finally, regulatory sovereignty. And that's guiding all these key domestic policy shifts. So our goal now is to traverse the entire government system by system and capture every single numeric point, every specific piece of language that became effective right at 12.01 AM EST.
Okay, let's unpack this. We have to start where the shift is most immediate and, frankly, most pronounced.
Mm-hmm.
The executive office of the president and that policy of deterrence through denial, the hardening of both our physical and our bureaucratic national boundaries.
That takes us directly to Presidential Proclamation 1998. This directive, which is formally titled Restricting and Limiting the Entry of Foreign Nationals to Protect the Security of the United States, well, it entered full force precisely at 12.01 a.m. Eastern Standard Time on January 1st.
That's a massive action to take on a holiday, and the scale of it is vast. This proclamation expands the previous travel ban framework to encompass a total of 39 nations. So to justify such a broad and immediate exclusion, what specific rationale, what reason did the administration actually cite?
But the rationale is very, very technical. It's focused entirely on a risk assessment of foreign governmental capabilities. So they cited insufficient information sharing and identity management deficiencies from these governments.
So it's about the other governments, not the people applying.
Exactly. What's fascinating here is the foundational logic. The policy burden, it shifts entirely. So the burden of proving admissibility moves from the individual applicant to the sovereign state of origin.
Right.
If that state cannot or maybe will not share criminal, terror, or identity data that meets U.S. standards, well, their citizens face a ban.
That immediately ties consular access to foreign intelligence cooperation. That changes the diplomatic calculus entirely. Okay, let's break down those 39 nations by the two tiers of impact Proclamation 1998 established. Tier one is obviously the most severe.
It is. Tier one, or full suspension, means a total cessation of standard consular processing. The issuance of all immigrant and non-immigrant visas is just suspended indefinitely. This applies to 19 nations.
For the archival record, we need that full list.
Okay, the 19 nations are Afghanistan, Burma, Chad, the Republic of the Congo, Equatorial Guinea, Eritrea, Haiti, Iran, Laos, Libya, Mali, Niger, Sierra Leone, Somalia.
Quite a list.
South Sudan, Sudan, Syria, Yemen, and finally, Burkina Faso.
Okay, I want to focus on the geopolitical context behind, including that Sahelian bloc, Mali, Niger, Burkina Faso, and Chad. That is a significant concentration of security concern right there.
It is. Their inclusion is a direct response to collapsed governance in that region and the strategic threat posed by Russian proxies. The administration explicitly links their poor information sharing to the presence of the Africa Corps.
What used to be the Wagner Group.
Exactly, formerly Wagner. They're now controlling security functions in parts of those nations. So the policy basically views these nations as intelligence black holes where the U.S. just cannot conduct reliable vetting. And that necessitates a full security exclusion.
And the policy applied to Haiti. On the surface, it seems incredibly contradictory. You have a security exclusion happening at the same time as a diplomatic gesture.
Mm.
How do we reconcile that stark policy bifurcation?
Well, it's a deliberate policy split. On January 1st, the proclamation bans Haitian nationals under this security mandate, citing the lack of institutional control amid gang violence and, really, civil war.
Right.
But simultaneously, the State Department issued a release celebrating Haiti National Day. So they're expressing diplomatic support for the state structure and its democratic transition. The administration is basically saying, we support the idea of the sovereign state, but because it's so unstable right now, we have to exclude the populace because the state can't vet them.
So it's containment paired with some distant diplomatic signaling.
That's a good way to put it.
Okay, let's move to tier two, partial suspension. This covered 20 nations with more targeted restrictions. Give us some examples and the strategic goals behind those targets.
So key examples here include Angola, Antigua and Barbuda, Dominica, Venezuela, and Turkmenistan. The targets here are often very specific compliance failures or financial loopholes.
And the Caribbean nations, that's interesting.
Yeah, consider the Caribbean nations, Antigua and Barbuda and Dominica. Their inclusion is central to what's being called the Citizenship by Investment Crackdown, or CBI crackdown.
Explain the CBI crackdown. Why did purchasing a passport in the Caribbean suddenly become a U.S. national security issue?
Well, the concern is simple. It's a failure of due diligence. The U.S. believes that illicit financial actors, fugitives, sanctioned individuals, they purchase passports from these CBI programs to get visa-free access to Western nations and, you know, to sanitize their identity.
I see.
So by imposing a partial ban, the administration is leveraging U.S. market access to force these small sovereign states to dramatically tighten their due diligence and their anti-money laundering controls.
And there was one nation's inclusion that was based on hyper-specific, quantifiable, data-driven metrics. Which nation was that, and what were the numbers?
That would be Angola. Angola's Tier 2 restriction is explicitly tied to non-compliance data cited right there in the proclamation, and the metrics they used were staggering.
Give them to us.
Angola had a B1-B2, that's business and tourism overstay rate, of 14.43%, and its student visa overstay rate was 21.92%.
Wow.
So this confirms that the administration is running a highly automated data-driven enforcement model where specific rates of non-compliance, not just, you know, political antagonism, can now trigger automatic visa sanctions. This sets a major precedent.
If an affected national tries to navigate this new system, what recourse is even available? It sounds like the proclamation really centralized waiver authority.
It did, significantly. The proclamation allows for waivers on a case-by-case basis if entry is deemed necessary for the national interest. But, and this is the key, obtaining one requires mandated coordination between the Secretary of State and the Secretary of Homeland Security.
So another layer of bureaucracy.
It's a bureaucratic layering designed to make humanitarian exceptions exceedingly rare. It reserves them almost exclusively for high-level diplomatic necessities or, say, exceptional medical cases. It ensures the general population can't easily circumvent the ban.
But the administration also put in a safe harbor provision? Presumably to avoid the immediate global chaos we saw in previous travel ban rollouts.
Yes, that was absolutely crucial for stability. The safe harbor provision grandfathers in existing, already vetted travelers. So nationals of affected countries who were outside the U.S. on January 1st, but who held a valid visa issued before that date, are not subject to revocation.
So they can still enter.
They may still enter, yes. The policy closes the door to future applications, but it avoids immediately disrupting the lives of travelers who are already vetted and granted access.
Okay, that addresses the visa side, which is managed by the State Department.
Right.
But at the exact same time, the Department of Homeland Security operationalized a new fee schedule, basically erecting a financial barrier at the irregular entry pathways.
Exactly. The revised DHS immigration fee schedule that was implemented on January 1st, it really focuses on pricing out certain pathways. The most significant change, and the one that drew immediate legal fire, is the new fee for processing humanitarian parole applications.
And what's that new fee?
It's now set at $1,020.
$1,020. That is highly specific, and for many people, that's effectively cost prohibitive.
Mm.
Why did the administration target humanitarian parole with such an aggressive fee?
Because humanitarian parole had become the key legal valve for managing large volumes of irregular migration from crisis zones. You have to think specifically of nationals from Ukraine, Venezuela, Cuba, and Haiti.
Right.
So by setting the fee at over $1,000, which often equates to multiple months of median wages in these countries, the administration transforms parole from a humanitarian protection mechanism into a pay-to-play system.
It's an economic deterrent.
It's a pure economic deterrent. It effectively chokes off the primary legal pathway for those without immediate financial resources, and it does so without requiring the administration to formally end the parole program itself.
So that fee represents the policy of denial. Now, to emphasize the strategic contrast here, what about the fee structure for legitimate, streamlined border crossing?
The policy bifurcation is crystal clear here. The fee for Form I-94, which is the arrival departure record required at land borders for non-immigrants, that remains steady at just $30.
$30.
Right. $24 for the base fee plus a $6 processing fee. Maintaining this low cost signals that the administration is prioritizing the continuous, legitimate flow of commerce and tourism while actively penalizing the irregular humanitarian pathways.
Okay, moving from border security over to trade policy now. The executive office also strategically delayed a major tariff increase that was scheduled to kick in on New Year's Day.
That's right. That was the proclamation delaying the scheduled tariff increases on wood products, which had been set for operationalization on January 1st, 2026. And the original planned increases, they were substantial.
How substantial?
The duty rate on upholstered furniture was set to rise from 25% to 30%, and the rate for kitchen cabinets and vanities was set to double, from 25% to a massive 50%.
So why the strategic pause? The administration has consistently prioritized a more protectionist trade policy.
Well, the delay was formally cited as being due to productive negotiations with trade partners, but the strategic reasoning is pretty critical. First, it serves as an inflationary hedge.
Also,
a 50% tariff on essential inputs like kitchen cabinets would immediately spike costs in the housing market. It could stall construction, remodeling, and just add huge inflationary pressure. So the delay prioritizes housing affordability and economic stability.
And the second reason?
Second, it retains the threat of that 50% rate as potent diplomatic leverage in ongoing negotiations. The delay doesn't eliminate the threat, it weaponizes the threat as a tool.
Turning to diplomacy and the president's focus leading into the new year, the schedule reflected a pretty intense push for conflict resolution overseas before the focus pivoted to the Indo-Pacific.
Absolutely. The diplomatic schedule was tightly packed. It was geared toward closing out current theaters of conflict. There was a bilateral meeting with the Israeli Prime Minister on December 29th that projected specific optimism for ending that war.
Which suggests a big push for a ceasefire agreement in early 2026.
It does. And this was mirrored by engagement with President Zelensky on December 28th, indicating active mediation on the Russia-Ukraine endgame. They're likely leveraging aid commitments to force a negotiated settlement and allow the U.S. to fully pivot its strategic resources eastward.
Okay, before we transition fully, there's a fascinating, very granular administrative detail from the State Department tied directly to inflation metrics that also kicked in on January 1st.
Yes, the foreign gifts minimal value adjustment. It's a small detail with huge ethical implications. So, effective January 1st, 2026, the General Services Administration, the GSA, in consultation with state, adjusted the minimal value definition for foreign gifts.
And why was that necessary?
Because of an 8.99% CPI increase over the last 3 years. This figure is critical because it determines which gifts U.S. officials can legally keep versus which ones have to be turned over to the National Archives to prevent ethics violations. That 8.99% number really shows the granular reach of inflation into federal ethics enforcement.
That covers the strategic overview from the executive branch. So let's pivot directly from financial deterrence to kinetic deterrence, the policy of peace through strength, starting with the Department of Defense and the immediate geopolitical confrontation in the Taiwan Strait.
Right. The year began with an immediate crisis that required a formal response from the State Department. The principal deputy spokesperson, Tommy Pigott, issued a formal press statement on January 1st, 2026, directly confronting the People's Republic of China's military actions.
And the trigger event was the PRC's large-scale drills, which were ominously titled Mission Justice 2025. What were the components of those exercises that necessitated a formal New Year's Day diplomatic rebuke?
These were maximum pressure drills. Mission Justice 2025 involved aggressive live fire components, and critically, it simulated a full naval and aerial blockade of Taiwan's main ports.
So not a standard exercise?
Not at all. This was a rehearsal for an invasion and for the strangulation of the island's economy. Beijing framed these actions as a stern warning to what they call separatist forces, which immediately set a very confrontational baseline for U.S.-China relations in 2026.
What was the specific language the U.S. used to respond? Was it conciliatory, or did it maintain a firm line?
The statement was calibrated to be very firm. The U.S. described the PRC's activities as unnecessarily increasing tensions. So it clearly frames Beijing as the destabilizing party. It reaffirmed the U.S. commitment to the status quo and, most crucially, opposition to unilateral changes by force or coercion.
Which is a paramount signal.
Absolutely. It shows that despite the administration's focus on American strength, the defense of the first island chain remains a non-negotiable foreign policy core interest.
Turning to the DoD internally now, the new fiscal year signals immediate doctrinal and personnel transformation. Let's start with the immediate implementation of military compensation increases.
Right. Effective January 1st, 2026, the DoD implemented a mandated 3.8% increase in basic pay for all military personnel. This raise is explicitly tied to matching the Employment Cost Index, the ECI, which reflects private sector wage growth. The whole mechanism is designed to keep military compensation competitive.
Is this a blanket raise, or is there still a targeted component aimed at retention in the lower ranks?
It is across the board, but the legislative authorization notes that this continues targeted efforts that were initiated back in fiscal year 2025, specifically for junior enlisted service members, those in the E1 to E4 pay grades.
So the focus remains on the lower ranks.
The focus remains on raising the floor of military compensation to directly combat issues like food insecurity and housing shortages, which have been, you know, retention killers among those lower ranks for years.
That focus on core combat readiness, that links directly to the doctrinal shift articulated by the Secretary of Defense, Pete Hegseth. It's been dubbed the Donroe Doctrine.
Mm-hmm.
What does this signal for resource allocation?
The Donroe Doctrine signals a fundamental cultural shift within the Pentagon. It's a move away from non-kinetic responsibilities. Hegseth's language is very direct. The War Department will not be distracted by democracy building, climate change, or social engineering.
So what are the operational implications of that?
A massive resource reallocation. Programs related to diversity initiatives, climate resiliency studies, or humanitarian aid functions. They are all likely to see severe cuts or even elimination, which frees up funds for lethality, for weapons acquisition, and for forward readiness.
That aggressive focus is undeniably reflected in the numbers for the fiscal year 2026 defense budget. What is the top line figure we're dealing with here?
The top line defense spending for FY 2026 is set at $961.6 billion.
Almost $1 trillion.
To put that number in context for you, that represents a massive 13.4% increase over the previous fiscal year 2025 budget. The stated legislative purpose is unequivocally to rebuild America's military and reestablish a decisive edge in global deterrence.
Okay, let's break down the spending priorities within that near $1 trillion allocation. Let's start with maintaining air dominance. Where are the generational investments being made?
A total of $4.2 billion is allocated specifically towards sixth-generation aircraft development. And this is meticulously split between the two major services.
Okay.
So $3.2 billion is designated for the Air Force's Next Generation Air Dominance, or NGAD, fighter program. And $972 million is allocated for the Navy's FAXX program. This concurrent funding is meant to ensure technological superiority is maintained across both air-to-air and carrier-based combat environments.
Which is critical for a potential Pacific conflict. And what specific investment is being made in the Space Force to ensure resilience against electronic warfare threats from Russia and China?
The Space Force received $680 million for procurement dedicated to advanced anti-jamming capabilities. Specifically, this funding is for two GPS ARF spacecraft.
And what's special about the THEF generation?
The THEF generation of GPS satellites are equipped with modernized anti-jamming technology and enhanced accuracy capabilities. It provides a necessary countermeasure against sophisticated adversarial efforts to degrade or deny U.S. space-based communication and targeting in a conflict.
Beyond just the hardware, the NDAA tasks the DoD with solving what's considered the most critical strategic vulnerability in a conflict with China, which is the logistics problem.
This is the contested logistics problem, and the explicit tasking in the NDAA represents a really sobering recognition of modern warfare. In a potential Pacific conflict, the U.S. cannot just assume safe passage for its supply lines.
No.
American logistical vessels, forward operating bases, they will be under constant threat from precision long-range fires. The military is fundamentally shifting its doctrine away from lean, efficient, just-in-time delivery models toward redundant, hardened supply chains and pre-positioned stockpiles.
So they're acknowledging that logistics must be secured as rigorously as frontline combat assets from day one.
From Day one of a conflict, yes.
This shift toward financial and kinetic strength brings us directly to a profound tension point in the government. This massive investment in external defense, juxtaposed with what some analysts are calling strategic self-sabotage in the crucial realm of domestic digital defense. This is where we have to discuss the cyber defense deficit at CISA.
Yes. This is where the budget priorities become, frankly, alarming. The immediate threat landscape is evolving faster than our defenses. The recent incident involving Anthropic illustrates this perfectly. A nation-state linked threat actor attempted to use Anthropic's commercial AI models to enhance its cyber espionage operations.
What does that case tell us about the speed and accessibility of this new threat?
It demonstrates that AI has become an asymmetric weapon that's accessible to hostile states. Cyber policy experts are warning that AI enables automated malware creation, vulnerability discovery, exploitation, all in mere minutes. A process that once required months of dedicated, specialized human labor.
So the barrier to entry for highly sophisticated cyber attacks has just plummeted.
Plummeted. It's making our defenses immediately outdated.
And yet, the agency charged with defending our digital backbone, CISA, is facing extreme deficiencies because of internal policy decisions. Tell us about this strategic self-sabotage in personnel and budget.
The situation is dire. CISA has lost nearly 1,000 seasoned experts, the very talent needed to combat these AI-powered threats. As a result, the agency is facing vacancy rates that are hovering around 40%.
40%.
And to compound this, the proposed CISA budget includes a cut of 17%, which has led to the loss of approximately one-third of their top-tier cyber forces since the start of the administration. This combination of hollowing out expertise and cutting operational funds, it sends a clear signal to our adversaries.
That the U.S. is willing to accept substantially greater risk in the digital domain.
That's exactly right.
That risk extends far beyond just federal networks. What are the specific critical infrastructure vulnerabilities CISA is warning about, particularly in water and healthcare systems?
Well, the attack surface is vast, and many of these systems were built decades ago without any kind of persistent threat modeling. Water systems are particularly vulnerable.
Why them specifically?
Because they're often decentralized. They're run at the local level by small municipalities that lack dedicated security staff, and they utilize aging, vulnerable equipment. Unlike, say, the power grid, there's often no robust equivalent resilience built into water treatment or distribution systems.
And the finding on hospitals is chilling. It really demands more attention.
It absolutely is. CISA's findings indicate that hospitals lose the ability to provide basic patient care, sanitation, and essential medical procedures within just 2 hours of a successful compromise.
2 hours?
Yes. Are we really saying that a sophisticated actor can take a major metro hospital offline, eliminating sanitation and patient care in the time it takes to watch a movie? This risk assessment warns that a disruption in one sector, like a municipal water utility, can rapidly cascade into others, like emergency medical care or food supply chains. It just demonstrates the fragility of our interconnected modern infrastructure.
Finally, CISA plays a vital role in global threat coordination that is now strained by these cuts. What specific international functions are being undermined by this loss of expertise?
CISA is the primary conduit for sharing unclassified, actionable threat information with foreign CERT's computer emergency readiness teams, multinational corporations, and critical infrastructure operators outside of the formal, you know, highly classified intelligence community structure.
So it's the key information sharing hub.
A vital one. The disbanding of specialized units focused on Russian operations, for example, is explicitly cited as straining these global relationships, weakening real-time channels of cooperation, and slowing the delivery of technical guidance and defensive playbooks worldwide. It leaves our global partners exposed.
Now let's transition from digital defense to domestic institutional realignment, specifically in the Department of Justice and the federal judiciary. January 1st, 2026, became a major political accelerant with the release of the Jack Smith deposition.
Yes, the House Judiciary Committee chose New Year's Day to release the full transcript and video of former special counsel Jack Smith's closed-door deposition. The timing was clearly calculated for maximum political impact, immediately serving as potent fuel for ongoing weaponization of government inquiries targeting the DOJ.
Smith defended his actions, of course, but what specific detail did he admit that his critics are seizing upon to discredit the original indictment narrative?
Smith defended his independence under oath, stating he would never take orders from a political leader to hamper another person in an election. However, the key evidentiary dispute critics focused on was his admission of reliance on secondhand hearsay.
Regarding which claim?
Regarding the high-profile claim that former President Trump lunged for the steering wheel on January 6th, Smith noted that conflicting witness accounts undercut that specific narrative. This admission gives lawmakers potent, specific ammunition to argue that the underlying factual basis for the original indictment was flawed or maybe overhyped.
Shifting to law enforcement governance, the No Secret Police Act is now in effect, and it targets agencies like the FBI and the U.S. Marshals Service. What does this law mandate for federal officers in public operations?
Effective January 1st, this act mandates transparency in federal law enforcement operations. It bans federal law enforcement officers, including those from the FBI, ICE, the U.S. Marshals Service, from wearing facial coverings that conceal their identity during public operations.
Are there any exceptions?
There are only narrow exceptions for physical safety, like a gas mask in a dangerous chemical environment, or for pre-approved undercover work. The core purpose is to mandate visible identification, which is a direct policy response to concerns about the anonymity doctrine previously used during civil unrest deployments.
We also have a massive, politically mandated transparency initiative underway at the DOJ related to the Jeffrey Epstein investigation.
Yes. The DOJ is currently executing a massive review of 5.2 million documents related to the Epstein investigation. The sheer scale of this review signals a mandated transparency initiative, and legal analysts project that this volume ensures a rolling disclosure process that will stretch throughout 2026 and potentially into 2027.
The potential for those files to implicate high-profile figures ensures this will remain a major focus.
Absolutely, across political and economic sectors.
We must also quickly note two key state-level judicial triggers that took effect on January 1st, and they immediately set up federal court confrontations.
Right. These state laws are poised to ignite major constitutional challenges. First, in Washington state, a new capital gains surcharge on businesses earning over $250 million took effect. This high-threshold state-level super tax will immediately face federal challenges over conflicts with federal tax law and the Dormant Commerce Clause.
So that could accelerate a tax fight all the way to the Supreme Court?
Potentially, yes. And second, California's new laws related to firearm manufacturing machines and the digital code used to produce ghost guns also became effective. This sets up a direct confrontation between state police powers and Second Amendment jurisprudence, which is now almost certain to be litigated immediately in the Ninth Circuit.
Let's move to the federal workforce itself, the most significant internal realignment in decades. OPM data now quantifies the staff reduction across the government in 2025.
The numbers confirm a radical downsizing. The administration's policy changes amounted to a net staffing decrease of about 10.8% government-wide for the 2025 fiscal year.
And how did that break down?
This was the result of a massive churn. The loss of more than 317,000 federal employees was coupled with the hiring of only 68,000 new personnel.
OPM Director Scott Cooper aggressively claimed that the vast majority of these losses were voluntary, leveraging the Deferred Resignation Program, or DRP. What was the specific percentage Cooper cited?
Cooper stated that over 92% left voluntarily via the DRP. However, critics immediately pushed back on that, arguing it was a semantic distinction.
A forced exodus, some called it.
Exactly. Many employees felt coerced, seeing the DRP as the lesser of two evils compared to waiting for later reorganization or firing. It was designed to circumvent the more arduous formal firing process.
Yeah. Let's detail the hardest hit agencies by scale, starting with the Department of Defense, which lost the most employees by volume.
Right. Despite the massive budget increase we just discussed, the DOD saw the largest reduction in civilian staff. They lost over 61,600 employees, which equated to an 8% reduction of its total civilian workforce.
Next, the Treasury Department, where the cuts were intensely concentrated in the IRS. What was the scale of that reduction?
Treasury lost over 31,600 employees. That resulted in a staffing reduction of nearly 28%, and that cut was surgically concentrated within the Internal Revenue Service. To illustrate the broad impact, the USDA also lost over 21,600 employees, amounting to a 22% reduction.
That 25% cut to the IRS workforce is staggering. What is the specific, quantifiable operational impact expected as the 2026 tax filing season begins?
The IRS watchdog has already issued a public warning. They're predicting likely severe issues with the 2026 tax filing season due to that drastic reduction in staff. Fewer agents means slower processing, delayed responses, and much longer wait times for basic taxpayer assistance.
And what about the broader workforce disruption?
It's quantifiable. A recent survey found that 29% of federal employees reported very large extent workplace disruption. That's nearly triple the 10% national average, which indicates a severe drop in morale and productivity across the board.
Contrast that broad civilian reduction with a highly targeted pay increase for specific federal law enforcement personnel, which was operationalized via OPM's new special salary rates.
Right. OPM established these new special salary rates to deliver a 3.8% pay raise to certain law enforcement personnel. The justification was clear: to recruit and retain staff for mission-critical law enforcement positions essential to implementing the administration's priorities.
To secure the border, enforce federal laws, and protect public safety.
Exactly.
And this 3.8% raise aligns exactly with the military raise, making it nearly quadruple the standard civilian raise. We need the full list of specific agencies and roles covered to really illustrate this targeted priority area.
Okay, the list is expensive, and it's focused on border and internal security. We're talking about Customs and Border Protection law enforcement officers, including Border Patrol agents and Air and Marine Interdiction agents, ICE personnel, including special agents and detention and deportation officers, Secret Service security specialists and investigators, Bureau of Prisons correctional officers, FBI special agents, DEA special agents, U.S. Marshals, service officers, and special agents.
And a few others.
And specialized criminal investigators in the Federal Protective Service, the State Department's Diplomatic Security Service, and the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives.
Was this targeted raise completely unrestricted, or was there a statutory cap applied to the highest paid officials?
There was a hard cap. OPM noted that the raise is subject to the statutory pay cap at Executive Schedule Level 4, which for 2026 is $197,200.
So some high-level managers wouldn't get the full 3.8%.
That's right. Some high-level, high-cost law enforcement managers whose base pay already approached or exceeded that limit were prevented from receiving the full 3.8% increase, though OPM did show that most received at least a 1% adjustment.
Moving to personnel benefits and immediate litigation. We saw a significant legal challenge filed against a key OPM policy change immediately on January 1st.
The Human Rights Campaign, or HRC, filed a legal complaint with the EEOC on New Year's Day on behalf of federal employees. This directly challenges the new OPM policy that eliminates coverage for chemical and surgical modification of an individual's sex traits through medical interventions in federal health insurance programs.
Can you humanize that complaint for us? What specific detail was provided about the plaintiff?
The complaint included testimony from four current federal workers, including a critical detail about a Postal Service employee whose daughter requires coverage for gender dysphoria treatment, specifically including puberty blockers and potentially hormone replacement therapy.
And the HRC argument.
The HRC complaint argues that the elimination of this coverage under the new OPM policy constitutes clear sex-based discrimination under federal law.
Finally, within HHS, the Make America Healthy Again initiative operationalized its first phase through major changes to SNAP benefits in five states.
This change affects more than a million SNAP recipients. In five specific states, Indiana, Iowa, Nebraska, Utah, and West Virginia benefits can no longer be used for items explicitly categorized as low nutritional value.
Things like soda, candy.
Soda, candy, and energy drinks, exactly. This initiative, which is aimed at reducing obesity and diabetes among recipients, introduces new complexity to the benefit structure and may lead to new logistical challenges at the point of sale.
We have systematically captured the massive operational shifts across the executive branch. Now let's pivot to financial regulation and entitlement costs, starting with the Department of the Treasury and FinCEN.
In what was a clear victory for the financial services lobby, FinCEN announced a major deregulatory delay. The anti-money laundering countering the financing of terrorism rule, the AML-CFT rule for registered investment advisors and exempt reporting advisors.
RAs and ERAs.
Right. That was delayed from its scheduled January 1st, 2026 effective date until a full 2 years later, January 1st, 2028.
A two-year pause is significant. What is the material impact of delaying this rule for RIAs and private equity?
This rule would have required hedge funds and private equity firms to implement robust AML compliance programs and, most importantly, to file suspicious activity reports, or SARs, with FinCEN regarding suspicious transactions.
So the two-year delay effectively pauses the effort to close the private equity loophole.
Exactly. It pauses the effort to close that long-recognized loophole in money laundering enforcement. This prioritizes the reduction of compliance costs for the financial sector over the expansion of financial surveillance.
What other key fiscal metrics were set by Treasury for 2026, specifically concerning the terrorism backstop?
Treasury established the Insurance Marketplace Aggregate Retention Amount, the IMRF for the Terrorism Risk Insurance Program, or TRIP, for 2026 at a massive figure, $58,673,180,666.
58 billion.
That specific dollar amount is critical because it represents the aggregate deductible that the entire insurance industry must pay out for certified acts of terrorism before the federal taxpayer backstop kicks in.
So the government is the insurer of last resort, but only after industry pays its nearly $59 billion share. In a final Treasury detail on outstanding debts.
Correct. The Bureau of the Fiscal Service updated the percentage rate used for assessing interest on outstanding federal debts for the 2026 calendar year, which affects collection and delinquency costs across various federal loan and liabilities.
Moving to entitlement costs. The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS, activated new Medicare Part B rates, representing a significant cost increase for seniors on January 1st. Give us the numbers.
The cost increases were significant, and they were driven by rising healthcare usage. The standard monthly premium increased to $202.90.
Which is a rise of how much?
That is a rise of $17.90, representing a substantial 9.7% jump from the 2025 rate of $185. Additionally, the annual deductible increased to $283.
What specific legislative or historical detail explains the magnitude of this increase?
There's a fascinating detail buried in the premium calculation. A small portion of the premium, specifically €2.20 per month, is explicitly a repayment for funds previously borrowed under legislative acts, like the Bipartisan Budget Act of 2015, which artificially suppressed premiums in earlier years. Now, that debt is being repaid by beneficiaries.
And how aggressively are high-income seniors being targeted through the income-related monthly adjustment amount, or IRMAA?
The IRMA tiers mean high earners are paying vastly more. Beneficiaries in the highest IRMAA tier, those with incomes exceeding $500,000, now pay a total of $689.90 per month for Part B.
$690 a month.
It clearly demonstrates the means-testing trajectory of Medicare, transforming it into a highly progressive system for the wealthy.
CMS also introduced a specific new premium for a highly specialized patient group, requiring only certain drug coverage.
Yes. A new standalone premium of $121.60 is now available for post-transplant patients who require coverage only for immunosuppressive drugs. This separate policy provides a defined, lower-cost option for a patient population with chronic, non-negotiable pharmaceutical needs.
Finally, within HHS, key provisions of H.R. 1, the flagship reconciliation bill, triggered major structural changes to Medicaid eligibility.
H.R. 1 operationalized two major shifts intended to control the program's expansion and costs. First, it set a mandatory expansion deadline of January 1st, 2026.
So states that hadn't expanded Medicaid had to do so by that date.
Right. They had to do so to receive the enhanced federal matching rate, which forces near universality in coverage. Second, to control federal liability, the retroactive coverage window for new enrollees is severely shortened to just 1 month prior to application, down from the previous 3 months.
Which significantly reduces federal liability for historical uncompensated care costs.
Exactly.
That brings us to the final major institutional shift of January 1st. The dramatic proposed transformation of patent law at the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, or USPTO, affecting intellectual property challenges.
The USPTO published proposed regulations that would fundamentally transform the inter partes review, or IPR, landscape. This is often described, and I think rightly so, as creating a one-and-done system for patent validity challenges before the Patent Trial and Appeal Board, the PTB.
So a massive shift toward benefiting patent owners over challenger.
A massive shift, yes.
This is highly complex, so we need to slow down and unpack each of the three key regulatory shifts. Start with the mandatory stipulation.
The mandatory stipulation fundamentally changes the calculus for a petitioner. They must now stipulate they will not pursue any invalidity challenges in other venues, district court, or the International Trade Commission if the PT chooses to institute the IPR.
So it's an all or nothing bet.
It is. If the IPR is instituted, the challenger forfeits all future anticipation and obviousness defenses in court, even those based on prior art not included in the original petition. It exponentially raises the stakes for filing an IPR.
The second major shift is the absolute bar, which creates an immunity shield for patents that survive even a minor court challenge.
Precisely. The proposed amendments prohibit IPR institution against claims that have survived any prior validity challenge, whether in district court, the ITC, or a previous USPTO proceeding. This is a mandatory bar with no exception for new evidence or new prior art that wasn't available or, you know, properly used in the previous proceeding.
But doesn't this first mover problem fundamentally warp the justice system? It seems to allow a minor court victory to permanently shield a potentially weak patent from true scrutiny.
It creates enormous strategic advantages for the patent owner. They are heavily incentivized to strategically sue smaller, resource-constrained defendants first. If that initial defendant mounts an inadequate challenge that the patent survives, well, the patent is then effectively immunized from all subsequent IPR attacks by major technology companies, regardless of how superior their prior art evidence may be.
And the third major shift targets the jurisdiction shopping between the courts and the PTG, the parallel proceedings prohibition.
This is a categorical bright-line rule that replaces discretionary standards. IPR institution is now barred if a district court trial or ITC determination will more likely than not occur before the PTTAB's final decision deadline.
That's a huge win for plaintiffs who file in known rocket dockets.
It is, like the Western District of Texas, where trials routinely happen within 18 months. By filing in those fast courts, the patent owner can use the threat of an imminent trial to effectively block IPR access entirely, forcing the challenger to defend in the more expensive, higher-stakes district court environment.
What are the specific industry implications of these three shifts? Who wins and who loses?
The industry implications are starkly divided. The amendments particularly benefit branded pharmaceutical companies. It makes it significantly harder for generic manufacturers to challenge patents efficiently through IPR.
And the big losers?
The big losers are high technology and software companies facing assertions from non-practicing entities, or NPEs, often known as patent trolls. NPEs can leverage these rules to protect weaker patents by strategically using resource-constrained first defendants and then asserting those validated patents against major industry players with dramatically increased confidence and leverage.
We have completed the archival record, traversing the government systematically, capturing every detail operationalized on January 1st, 2026. What is the key takeaway for you, the listener, trying to synthesize this vast quantity of action?
Well, we confirm that the first day of the new year was defined by the activation energy of the administration's second term. It was marked by institutionalized restriction and massive investment. On the one hand, we see that policy of deterrence through denial abroad.
Right. Manifested by Proclamation 10998, the expansion to 39 nations, and that highly specific cost prohibitive $1,020 fee for humanitarian parole.
Exactly.
And on the other hand, the aggressive piece through strength defense posture.
Absolutely. The government is making massive near-trillion-dollar investments in kinetic deterrence. The $961.6 billion FY 2026 budget, the $3.2 billion for Air Force NGAD, the $972 million for Navy FAXX, and the $680 million for two advanced GPS dive satellites. Every dollar here screens preparation for an external state-on-state confrontation.
But the internal tension we identified, the one between that kinetic investment and digital vulnerability, that remains the overriding conflict that defines the risk profile for this new year.
It is the great paradox. We are pouring unparalleled resources into external traditional defense, but simultaneously allowing critical infrastructure security to erode via strategic self-sabotage. The CISA budget cut of 17%, the loss of 1,000 seasoned experts, the resulting 40% vacancy rate,
leaving critical daily systems, like hospitals, vulnerable to failure within just 2 hours of compromise.
Yes.
So if we connect these threats, the investment in theoretical strength versus the hollowing out of tangible resilience, what is the provocative thought we leave with the listener today?
It raises a really important question for you to mull over. Is the federal apparatus prioritizing theoretical strength against external adversaries? The kind of threats that dominate the headlines at the expense of tangible stability and resilience in the critical daily systems that keep the country running? That disconnect between massive military funding and digital self-neglect, that may be the most defining vulnerability of the year ahead.